Evelyn Carter did not scream when Jonathan Hale slipped the ring onto another woman's finger. She stood perfectly still in the center of Ashford Hall, while 200 guests turned to watch her fall apart. She did not fall. She pressed her nails into her palm until the pain was the only real thing in the room. If you've ever been left standing while the world kept moving, this story is for you. Subscribe to our channel, follow Evelyn's story all the way to the end, and drop your city in the comments. Let us see how far this goes. The morning of Jonathan Hale's wedding, Evelyn Carter woke before sunrise. She lay still in the narrow bed of her cousin Ruth's guest room, listening to the cicadas outside the window, counting the minutes. The way a woman counts the last of something she knows she is about to lose. She had been doing that for months counting. The 14 months of her engagement to Jonathan. The 6 weeks since he had stopped coming to call. The 4 days since the invitation arrived at her door, addressed not to her as his intended, but simply as a guest. A guest. She had read that word 3 times before she understood what it meant. Ruth had found her standing in the hallway holding the envelope. Ruth, who never minced words, who had grown up alongside Evelyn in the Carter household and knew every shade of her cousin's grief, before Evelyn herself could name it, had said only, "You don't have to go." "I know," Evelyn said. "Then don't." "I'm going." Ruth had pressed her lips together and said nothing more. That was the thing about Ruth, she always knew, when an argument was already lost. Evelyn dressed herself that morning without asking for help. She chose the pale blue gown, the one Jonathan had once said made her eyes look like a Virginia sky in June. She did not choose it for him. She chose it because it was the finest thing she owned, and she would not walk into Ashford Hall looking like a woman who had already been defeated. She arrived at the hall alone. The doors were tall and white and hung with summer roses, and the air coming off the James River was thick and hot, the way Virginia always was in August, the kind of heat that pressed down on your shoulders and made every breath feel like work. Carriages lined the road for a quarter mile in both directions. The Hale family had always known how to make an occasion feel like a verdict. She walked in. The first person to see her was Margaret Hale, Jonathan's mother, who stood near the entrance with a glass of lemonade and an expression that shifted from surprise to something colder and more careful. She did not speak. She simply looked at Evelyn the way a woman looks at a problem she thought had already been handled. Evelyn nodded to her. "Mrs. Hale." "Miss Carter." A pause that lasted exactly long enough to mean something. "I didn't expect you to come." "I was invited," Evelyn said. Another pause. "So you were." She moved past her. The hall was full. 200 guests at least, maybe more, merchants and magistrates, landowners and their wives, every family of consequence in 3 counties. They were dressed in their finest summer silks, fanning themselves against the August heat, talking and laughing in the low conspiratorial way of people who all know the same secret. Evelyn felt their awareness of her move through the room like a current. Heads turned. Conversations halted for just a beat, just long enough for her to feel the weight of every set of eyes before they slid away again. She found a place near the back. She stood straight. She did not look for Jonathan. She looked for him anyway. He was at the front of the hall near the altar that had been dressed with white magnolia blossoms, standing with 2 other men she didn't recognize. He was wearing a coat she had never seen before, deep navy, beautifully cut, and he looked exactly like the man she had agreed to marry 14 months ago, the man who had stood on her father's porch on a cold October evening and told her she was the only woman he had ever been certain of. He hadn't looked at her yet. She was grateful for that. The music began and the crowd shifted, and then the woman came down the aisle. Her name, Evelyn would later learn, was Charlotte Whitmore. The daughter of a Whitmore family from Charleston, old money, older name, the kind of family that had been signing documents and shaping decisions in the South since before independence. Charlotte was beautiful in the way that expensive things are beautiful, deliberately, precisely, with no detail left to chance. Her gown was ivory silk. Her dark hair was pinned with pearl combs. She walked with the serene confidence of a woman who had never doubted her own welcome in any room. Jonathan turned when she reached him. and he smiled. That was the thing Evelyn had not prepared for. Not the ceremony, not the guests, not even seeing his face. She had prepared for all of those things. She had not prepared for that smile, the particular private, unguarded quality of it, the way his whole face changed the way he looked at Charlotte Whitmore, the way you look at something you cannot believe you get to keep. He had never smiled at Evelyn that way. She realized it now, standing in the back of Ashford Hall, with 200 people around her, that she had never once, in 14 months, seen Jonathan Hale look at her like she was something he was afraid to lose. The minister began to speak. Someone nearby, a woman in yellow silk, someone's wife, someone Evelyn had met at a dinner once and could not now name, leaned toward her companion and whispered something behind her fan. The companion looked at Evelyn. They both looked away. Evelyn pressed her nails into her palm. The minister was saying words about covenant and witness and the grace of God. Jonathan was holding Charlotte Whitmore's hands. The white magnolias were beautiful. The hall was hot. A child somewhere near the front had begun to fuss quietly and was being hushed by its mother. "Do you, Jonathan Hale, take this woman?" "Yes," Jonathan said. He didn't wait for the rest of the sentence. The crowd rippled with quiet, indulgent laughter. Charlotte Whitmore blushed. Evelyn breathed. She had told herself she would not make a sound. She had told herself she would stand through it and then walk out the same way she had walked in, with her back straight and her chin level and nothing on her face that anyone could report back as weakness. She had told herself it was just a ceremony, just a room full of people, just one man making a different choice. She had believed herself until right now. "And do you take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward?" The ring was gold. She could see it from where she stood. Jonathan slid it onto Charlotte Whitmore's finger, and the room exhaled with collective approval, and someone in the front pew dabbed at their eye with a handkerchief, and the minister was saying something else now. Something about pronouncing, and the crowd was already beginning to shift and murmur in anticipation of celebration. And then Jonathan Hale looked up. He looked up and across the room, and for one long, unguarded moment his eyes found Evelyn's. She watched something move across his face. She could not name it. It was not guilt exactly. It was not triumph. It was something more complicated than either the expression of a man who has made a calculation and found it correct, and feels somewhere underneath the correctness, a small and persistent unease that he has already decided to ignore. She held his gaze for 3 full seconds. Then she turned and walked toward the door. She made it 6 steps before the laughter started. Not loud, not cruel in any deliberate way. Just the natural social laughter of a crowd that had found its release, the rippling, self-satisfied sound of 200 people who had all been waiting to see what the discarded woman would do. Someone made a remark she couldn't quite hear. Someone else responded. The laughter spread the way laughter does in a room full of people who are all relieved it isn't happening to them. Evelyn stopped walking. She didn't know why. She had meant to keep moving, meant to push through the tall white doors and out into the August heat, where at least the humiliation would be private. But something in her refused. Some stubborn, infuriating, inconvenient part of her that had been refusing things her entire life dug in and would not move. She turned back around. She faced the room. 200 people, and most of them were looking at her now, and she made herself stand in that look the way you stand in weather, not enjoying it, not pretending it wasn't there, just enduring it with whatever you had left. "Miss Carter." The voice came from her left, and it was low and quiet, not loud enough to carry through the whole room, but somehow the whole room heard it anyway. Or perhaps it was that the whole room went still enough that even a quiet voice seemed to fill the space. She turned. The man standing 3 feet away from her was someone she had seen before, in the way you have seen important things before, at a distance in passing, in the brief and formal encounters of Virginia society, where significant men moved through rooms and left impressions without ever making themselves fully known. General Nathaniel Blackwood. She knew his name. Everyone in Virginia knew his name. He had come back from the war 2 years ago to quiet and considerable consequence, a hero, a landowner, a man about whom nothing seemed to be publicly discussed, and yet everything seemed to be privately understood. He was taller than she remembered from those brief impressions. Broader through the shoulders with the particular deliberate stillness of a man accustomed to making rooms around him, settled down. He was wearing a dark coat, not military, but formal, and cut with the kind of precise attention that whispered money without shouting it. His face was not handsome in any conventional, carefully arranged way. It was a face that had been through things. Strong jaw. Eyes that were dark and direct, and at this particular moment fixed entirely on her. "Miss Carter," he said again, with the quiet assurance of a man who expected to be heard. "General Blackwood." Her voice came out steadier than she had any right to expect. "I believe the garden is considerably more tolerable than this room at present," he said. "I would consider it a personal favor if you would accompany me." She stared at him. He was offering his arm, just like that. No explanation. No declaration. No public performance of outrage on her behalf that would itself become a spectacle. Just a hand extended and a door implied, and the very quiet, very deliberate suggestion that she did not have to stand in this room for one moment longer than she chose to. "Why?" she said. "Because," he said without lowering his voice, "a woman of your character deserves considerably better company than what is currently on offer in this hall. And because I came to this wedding on business that is now concluded, and I find I would prefer to take the air with someone worth talking to." The room was very quiet. She looked at his arm. She looked at his face. She could feel without looking the 200 people behind her watching every second of this. "I don't need your charity, General," she said. "I'm not offering charity." Something moved in his expression, not quite a smile, not quite anything she could name. "I'm offering my arm. The difference is significant. For reasons she could not have fully explained, reasons that had something to do with the ring on Charlotte Whitmore's finger and the laughter she had heard 6 steps ago, and the 3 seconds of Jonathan Hale's complicated gaze, and the particular quality of stubbornness that had been getting her into trouble her entire life, Evelyn Carter put her hand on General Nathaniel Blackwood's arm. And she walked out of Ashford Hall. Behind her, the silence lasted for exactly the time it took for them to pass through the tall white doors. Then the murmuring began again, and she could hear it swell as the doors swung shut, the sound of 200 opinions forming simultaneously, each one of them, about her. She didn't stop walking. The garden behind Ashford Hall ran down toward the river, and the August heat was softer here under the old oaks than it had been inside the hall where every candle and every body had conspired to make the air feel used up. Cicadas were loud in the grass. Somewhere far down the slope, the James River moved against its banks. Blackwood said nothing for a long moment. She didn't either. Then, "You didn't have to do that," she said. "I did," he said simply. "Why?" He was quiet for a beat. "Because I've known Jonathan Hale for 11 years, he said, "and I know what kind of man does what he did this morning. And I know what kind of woman stands in the back of that room and doesn't flinch." He paused. "That kind of woman should not have to walk out of a room like that alone." She looked at him. "You know nothing about me," she said. "Bito di meids." "I know enough," he said. "I know your father, knew him rather." Something shifted in his expression, something careful, and considered that she couldn't quite read. "James Carter was a man I respected." She stopped walking. "My father has been dead for 8 months, she said. "I know," Blackwood said. "I was sorry to hear it." She studied his face. "You knew him personally." "We had dealings," he said. "Some years ago, and more recently." He paused again, and the pause had a quality to it that she didn't like, that particular weight of words being selected and others being held back. "He was a man of considerable conscience. That is not always a safe quality in Virginia." She felt something cold move through her despite the August heat. "What are you saying?" she said. He looked at her steadily. "I'm saying that your father was a man of integrity, and that integrity, in my experience, tends to make certain kinds of enemies." He stopped there. I should not say more at present. You should say considerably more, she said. Her voice was sharper than she intended. You've just walked me out of my former fiancé's wedding in front of half of Virginia Society General. You've said my father's name in a tone that suggests you know something I don't. I think you've well passed the point of should at this moment. He looked at her for a long moment. And then, for the first time, something in his face loosened, not quite a smile, but something that might have been the beginning of respect. You're right, he said. I apologize. He turned to face her fully. There are things regarding your father's death that I believe have not been properly investigated. Things I have reason to suspect were not accidental. I don't say this to cause you pain. I say it because you have a right to know, and because... He paused. Because I believe the same people who arranged his silence may have had something to do with what happened to you this morning. Evelyn said nothing. The cicadas were very loud. Jonathan Hale, Blackwood said carefully, did not choose Charlotte Whitmore on his own. He was guided to that choice by men with interests significantly larger than love or marriage. She stared at him. That is an extraordinary claim, she said. Yes, he agreed. It is. And you can prove it. Not yet, he said. But I intend to. She looked out at the river for a moment. The water moved slow and dark under the summer light, and she thought about her father, about James Carter, who had died 8 months ago, of what the doctor called a failure of the heart, what the county had called a tragedy, what no one had called anything other than those two things, because there had been no reason to call it anything else. No reason that she had known of. Who are these men? She asked. The ones you're speaking of. Blackwood was quiet for a moment. Then, there is a name, he said. A senator. A man with interests in this state that go considerably deeper than public record. He said the name quietly, as if the garden itself might be listening. Augustus Crowley. The name meant something to her. It meant something to everyone in Virginia, the way certain names always did. The kind of name you heard in conversations that stopped when you entered the room, the kind of name attached to decisions that seemed to arrive already made, as if the process of making them had happened somewhere you weren't allowed to be. Senator Crowley, she repeated. The same. She turned back to face him. Why are you telling me this? Because, Blackwood said. And for a moment, the careful, composed surface of him seemed to settle into something more direct. I have been trying to find a way to address what I know for 2 years. I have evidence, but evidence without witness, without cooperation, without someone who has standing to question, is only paper. He held her gaze. Your father had that standing. He was going to use it. And now he's dead, she said. And now he's dead. Blackwood agreed quietly. But you are his daughter. She understood then what he was asking. Or not asking, offering. The distinction, as he had said, was significant. She stood in the garden of Ashford Hall on the August morning of Jonathan Hale's wedding to another woman with the sound of celebration beginning to drift from the hall behind her. And she felt something she had not expected to feel today, of all days. The very clear, very cold, very particular sensation of purpose. You should know, she said, that I am currently without much in the way of resources, reputation, or social standing. Whatever Jonathan Hale and his associates have arranged for this morning has made certain of that. I know, Blackwood said. And you're still here. I'm still here, he said. She looked at him for a long moment. Tell me, she said. Tell me everything you know about my father and Senator Crowley. Tell me all of it, and don't spare anything, because you think I can't bear it. Something moved through his expression, that same thing that might have been the beginning of respect a little further along now. That, he said quietly, could take some time. Then we had better start, said Evelyn Carter, before they come looking for us. And in the garden behind Ashford Hall, with the river moving slow and dark below them, and the sound of a celebration she had not been invited to. Feeling very far away, General Nathaniel Blackwood began to tell her the truth about her father's death. And nothing, not one single thing in the world she had known this morning, was ever exactly the same again. Blackwood did not tell her everything that morning. He told her enough. He told her that her father, James Carter, had spent the last year of his life quietly assembling something, letters, ledgers, records of transactions that did not appear in any official account of Senator Augustus Crowley's business dealings. He told her that James had come to him 6 months before his death, not as a man seeking help, but as a man seeking a witness, someone who would know what to look for if things went wrong. He told her that James Carter had believed Crowley was using Virginia's shipping routes to move money in ways that bypassed federal oversight, and that three men who had attempted to bring that information to light in the previous decade had each met with circumstances that discouraged further inquiry. He did not tell her what he suspected about the manner of her father's death. Not yet. She noticed the omission. She filed it away. What she said when he had finished was, "My father never told me any of this." "He wouldn't have," Blackwood said. "He was protecting you. He was keeping me ignorant. He believed they were the same thing." She turned that over in her mind for a moment. "And the ledgers. The letters he assembled. I don't know where they are," Blackwood said. "He told me he had placed them somewhere safe. Somewhere no one would think to look for them without knowing what they were looking for." He paused. "I had hoped, after his death, that they might have been among his effects." "His effects," she said slowly. "His house. His papers." She looked at him. "His house that passed to his creditors 8 months ago, because his debts that appeared after his death debts that no one could satisfactorily account for, exceeded the value of the estate." Blackwood was very still. "I didn't know about the debts," he said. "Most people didn't," she said. "It was handled very quietly, very quickly. I was given 3 days to remove my personal belongings before the house was handed over." She let that sit between them for a moment. "Someone went through his study before I did. I know because I knew that study. I knew where my father kept everything, and there were gaps. Not obvious ones. Not the kind of gaps a creditor would make. The kind of gaps someone makes when they know exactly what they're looking for." Blackwood said nothing for a long moment. "Miss Carter," he said finally, "I owe you an apology." "Why?" "Because I have been approaching this problem as if I were the one with the most at stake," he said. "I see now that I was wrong about that." She looked at him steadily. "Yes," she said. "You were." They stood in the garden for a while longer, and the celebration inside Ashford Hall continued without them, and Evelyn felt the strange doubled quality of the morning, the wedding, and this conversation existing in the same hour, the same heat, the same August air, as if reality had simply decided to put too many things in the same place at once. When they finally walked back toward the hall, not inside but toward the carriages, Blackwood said, "I'd like to call on you, in a formal capacity, if you would permit it." "To discuss my father," she said. "Among other things." She stopped walking. "General Blackwood, I need to be clear about something. I am not interested in being managed. I am not interested in being protected in the way my father protected me, which is to say, kept comfortable and uninformed. If you want my cooperation, if you want access to whatever I might know or find or be able to do, then you will tell me everything. Not the version you decide I can handle. Everything." He looked at her for a long moment. "That is a significant thing to ask," he said. "I'm aware. Some of what I know," he said carefully, "is dangerous. Not philosophically. Actually, dangerous. The kind of dangerous where knowing it changes what other people are willing to do to you." "My father is dead," she said. "My fiancé married another woman this morning. My house is gone. My reputation in this county is currently being reassembled by 200 people who just watched me walk out of a wedding on your arm." She held his gaze. "General, I'm not sure what exactly you think I have left to protect." Something moved through his expression, something that was not quite sympathy and not quite admiration, and was, she thought, the particular look of a man recalibrating. "All right," he said quietly. "Everything." "Good," she said. "Call on me at Ruth's tomorrow afternoon." She climbed into Ruth's waiting carriage without looking back. Ruth, who had been sitting inside it for the better part of 2 hours with the patience of a woman who had long since made peace with the fact that her cousin's life was never going to be simple, looked at her. "Well," Ruth said. "Well?" Evelyn agreed. "You were in there for 20 minutes and in the garden for an hour and a half." "Yes." "With General Blackwood?" "Yes." Ruth looked at her for a moment with the careful measuring expression she deployed when she was deciding how much to say. "Evelyn, what is happening?" Evelyn looked out the window as the carriage began to move. Inside Ashford Hall, she could hear faintly distantly the sound of music starting up. The wedding celebration. The future Mr. and Mrs. Jonathan Hale beginning whatever life they had arranged for themselves. "I'm not entirely sure yet," she said. "But I think I'm going to find out what happened to my father." Ruth was quiet for a moment. Then, "I was afraid you were going to say something like that." "I know. It's going to be complicated." "I know. And dangerous, probably." "Probably." Ruth looked at her hands. Then she looked up. "All right," she said. "Then you're going to need me." Evelyn finally turned from the window. "Ruth, don't," Ruth said firmly. "Don't tell me it's safer if I'm not involved. Don't tell me you can manage on your own. I have been managing things alongside you since we were 8 years old, and you decided to climb the Henderson's oak tree because someone told you it couldn't be done." She paused. "You're not doing this alone." Evelyn looked at her cousin for a moment. "He fell off that tree," Evelyn said. "You caught his arm before he hit the ground," Ruth said. "My point stands." For the first time that morning, the first time since she had woken before sunrise and dressed herself in the pale blue gown and pressed her nails into her palm, Evelyn Carter felt something loosen in her chest that she had not realized was held tight. "All right," she said. "Together." Ruth nodded once with the decisive satisfaction of a woman whose argument has been accepted. "Now, tell me what that man said to you in the garden." Blackwood arrived the following afternoon exactly when he said he would, which Evelyn noted with the particular appreciation of someone who had spent 14 months with a man who was consistently 20 minutes late to everything and treated punctuality as a suggestion. He came alone without the formal entourage of servants and social performance that a man of his position might have deployed. He carried a leather satchel. He accepted the chair Ruth offered him in the small front parlor with the brief, courteous ease of a man who did not need his surroundings to confirm his importance. He set the satchel on the low table between them. "I've been carrying these for 2 years," he said, "waiting for the right moment and the right person." He paused. "I believe this is both." He opened the satchel. Inside were letters. 40, perhaps 50 of them, some in envelopes, some folded flat, written in different hands, different inks on different grades of paper that told their own story of different stations and different circumstances. These, Blackwood said, are correspondence between various parties connected to Senator Crowley's business interests, land transactions, shipping contracts, payments made to county officials across 4 states. He laid several of them on the table. "None of them alone constitutes proof of anything. Together they describe a pattern, a very specific pattern of influence and concealment that goes back at least 15 years. Evelyn reached for the nearest letter. "May I?" He gestured for her to proceed. She read. The handwriting was careful and formal, the language of men who were accustomed to committing things to paper and equally accustomed to writing in the particular way that allowed them to later claim the paper meant something other than what it clearly meant. But she had grown up in her father's house, and her father had been a man who dealt in land and trade, and she understood how these letters worked the code of commerce and obligation that ran beneath the surface of polite phrasing. "This is an instruction," she said. "This sentence here ensures that the matter of the Hale Tract is resolved to the satisfaction of all interested parties before the winter session. That means someone was being told to deliver a vote." Blackwood looked at her. "Yes," he said. "That is exactly what it means." "And the Hale Tract," she said slowly. "That's the property that Jonathan Hale's family acquired in 1814, Blackwood said, at a price that was significantly below its actual value, from a seller who had in the preceding months experienced considerable difficulties with his existing debts. Evelyn set the letter down. Jonathan knew, she said. It was not a question. Jonathan's father knew, Blackwood said carefully. What Jonathan himself knew and when is something I have not been able to determine with certainty, but you suspect. I suspect, he agreed, that Jonathan Hale is not an architect. He is a beneficiary. There is a difference, though. It is not always a comfortable one. She thought about that. She thought about 14 months of Jonathan Hale, his charm, his easy confidence, the particular way he had of making every room feel like a place he already owned. She thought about the 6 weeks of silence before the wedding. She thought about the invitation addressed to her as a guest. Charlotte Whitmore, she said. Her family. Charleston money, Blackwood said. And more importantly, Charleston shipping interests. The Whitmore family controls 3 of the major port operations in South Carolina. He paused. Senator Crowley has been attempting to extend his influence into those ports for 4 years. A marriage between the Hale family and the Whitmore family creates precisely the kind of connection he requires to make that extension possible. Evelyn felt the entire architecture of the morning. Before the wedding, the hall. The ring on Charlotte Whitmore's finger settle into a different shape. Not a love story. Not even a betrayal exactly. A transaction. She had been part of a calculation that had simply run its course, and when the calculation changed, she had been set aside without ceremony, because ceremony was not something you extended to a component that had been replaced. My father, she said. Her voice came out very steady. She was distantly proud of that. He knew about the Hale land deal. He did, Blackwood said. He was one of the original sellers that Crowley's network had targeted 4 years before his death. He refused the arrangement. He was not the kind of man to be easily pressured. He stopped. But he was also not the kind of man to let something like this rest. Once he understood what he was dealing with, he began to document it, quietly, over years. And then he died, Evelyn said. Blackwood looked at her directly. And then he died. The room was very quiet. Ruth, who had been sitting near the window with a piece of embroidery she had not once actually looked at, set it down on her knee. You're telling us, Ruth said, with the precision of a woman who wanted no room for ambiguity, that Senator Crowley had James Carter killed. I am telling you, Blackwood said with equal precision, that I believe that to be true. I cannot yet prove it. The physician who signed the death record is a man with ties to Crowley's network. The timing of your father's death 3 weeks before he had arranged a meeting with a federal contact in Washington is, in my assessment, not a coincidence. He paused. I want to be honest with you both about where the evidence currently stands. I believe it. I cannot yet prove it. Evelyn stood up. She walked to the window. She looked out at the street, at Ruth's quiet, ordinary neighborhood, the neighbors going about their quiet, ordinary afternoons, the world continuing its business in the cheerful, indifferent way it always did. Her father had been a careful man, a private man, a man who kept things close and people at arm's length and trusted very few. And he had built in the last years of his life a case against one of the most powerful men in Virginia, alone quietly, without telling his daughter. He had been trying to protect her. He had gotten himself killed for it. And the man who may have ordered his death had then, through the network of obligation and arrangement that he operated like a spider at the center of a web, quietly arranged for Jonathan Hale to marry into the Whitmore family, which had ended Evelyn's engagement, dissolved her social standing, and left her with nothing to fall back on. He took everything, she said, not loudly, just as a statement of fact. Not everything Blackwood said from behind her. He didn't account for you, she turned around. The documents, she said. The ones my father assembled. The ones that were taken from his study. Yes. They were not all taken, she said. Blackwood went very still. Ruth looked up. What? Blackwood said. My father was a careful man, Evelyn said. She moved back to the table. She sat down. He kept his most important papers in his study. Any thorough person looking through his house would naturally focus on the study, on the desk, the cabinet, the shelves. She paused. He told me once, I was perhaps 12 years old, that the most dangerous place to keep something important was somewhere important. He said that people looking for things always looked in the significant places first and moved through the ordinary ones too quickly. Blackwood had not moved. Evelyn, Ruth said very quietly. What are you saying? I'm saying... Evelyn said that my father kept a Bible. An old one, his mother's. It sat on the small shelf in his bedroom, not the study, the bedroom, alongside three other books, and a small wooden cross. It was entirely unremarkable. The kind of thing no one removes when they're clearing a man's house because it has no obvious value and no obvious significance. She looked at Blackwood. I have it. I took it when I was given my 3 days to clear my belongings. I took it because it was his mother's, and I couldn't leave it. She paused. I have not yet opened it. I had no reason to until this moment. Blackwood leaned forward. Miss Carter, he said, and his voice had a quality in it she had not heard before, something beneath the controlled, deliberate surface of him. Something that might, in another man, have been urgency. Where is the Bible now? Here, she said. Upstairs. He looked at her for a moment. Would you be willing to retrieve it? She was already standing. Ruth went with her. They climbed the stairs of the small house together, and Ruth's hand found her arm briefly on the landing, and neither of them said anything, because there was nothing to say that the touch didn't already cover. Evelyn went into the guest room, where she had been sleeping since her father's house had been taken, and she went to the small wooden box she had brought with her, the box that held the things she had been able to carry in 3 days. And she opened it, and she lifted out the Bible. It was old. The cover was worn soft with decades of handling the spine fragile, the pages yellowed and thin. Her grandmother's name was written on the inside front cover in faded brown ink. She had not opened it since the day she packed it. She opened it now, and there tucked between the pages of the Book of Psalms were papers. Folded careful and flat, the creases so old they had softened into the pages. 7 sheets covered in her father's handwriting. His particular cramped, deliberate hand that she would have known anywhere. She stood in the guest room of Ruth's small house on a Tuesday afternoon in August 1815, holding her dead father's handwriting in her hands. Her legs felt uncertain. Ruth's hand came to her arm again. Come downstairs, Ruth said quietly. Evelyn folded the papers back into the Bible. She held it against her chest. She breathed. All right, she said. Yes. When they came back into the parlor, Blackwood stood up. He looked at the Bible in her arms, and then he looked at her face, and he did something she did not expect. He did not reach for it. He did not ask. He simply stood and waited and let her be the one to decide. She set the Bible on the table. She opened it to the Psalms. She took out the papers, and she laid them flat, and she smoothed them with her palm, and she began to read. The room was very quiet. Outside, the afternoon continued. Somewhere down the street, a child was calling to another child in the high, unconcerned way of children who had no knowledge of and no interest in the things happening inside this house. Evelyn read for 4 minutes without speaking. Then she looked up. He names him, she said. Her voice was very steady. Directly, by name. In the context of a specific payment made in February of 1813 to 2 men named here for services rendered in connection with the death of a man called William Price, a federal customs agent. She looked at Blackwood. Who was William Price? Blackwood sat down slowly. William Price, he said, was the man your father was going to meet in Washington, the federal contact. He paused. He died in a carriage accident in the spring of 1813. He didn't die in an accident, Evelyn said. She looked back at the paper. My father says so. He has the payment record. He has the names of the men who were paid. She looked up again. And he has something else. What? A signature, she said. On a document authorizing those payments. She turned the paper so Blackwood could see it. Senator Augustus Crowley's signature. The room went absolutely still. Blackwood looked at the paper for a long time, then he looked at her. Miss Carter, he said very quietly, do you understand what you're holding?
I believe so, she said.
That is not a matter for county court, he said. That is not a matter for Virginia at all. That is evidence of a federal crime, murder of a federal officer. That goes to Washington. That goes to men who have both the authority and I believe the motivation to act on it. He paused. If we can get it there safely, and if we can get there before Crowley learns what exists.
He doesn't know, Evelyn said. His people went through the study. They didn't find this.
As far as Senator Crowley is concerned, whatever my father assembled died with him.
That is our only advantage, Blackwood said, and it will not last indefinitely. The moment we begin making inquiries, the moment we contact anyone in Washington, the moment this begins to move, he will know something is happening.
Ruth from her chair said, then we need to move quickly. Both of them looked at her.
I am not simply embroidering over here, Ruth said with the mild dignity of someone making a point that should not have needed making.
We need to move quickly, we need to move carefully, and we need to think about who in Washington can be trusted before we contact anyone.
She looked at Blackwood directly.
You said you've known Jonathan Hale for 11 years. Who else do you know? Who do you have in the federal city who is outside Crowley's reach?
Blackwood looked at Ruth for a moment with an expression that suggested he was revising something.
There is a man, he said. A judge. Samuel Archer. He has been in federal service for 20 years and has no business connections to any of Crowley's interests. He is also a man who is personally acquainted with William Price.
He paused. If anyone in Washington has both the standing to receive this and the personal motivation to pursue it, it is him.
Can you reach him without alerting Crowley? Evelyn asked.
I believe so, Blackwood said. I would need to travel to Washington, personally and without announcement.
He paused. That means leaving Virginia quietly, without my usual entourage, without the kind of official departure that generates questions.
When? Evelyn said.
He looked at her. How quickly can you make copies of those documents?
I can begin tonight, she said.
Then within the week, he said.
I'll leave within the week.
She was already looking back at the papers, at her father's handwriting, at the careful, dangerous record he had assembled, and hidden, and died for, at the signature of the man who had taken everything, and believed he had left no trace.
He thought he was safe, she said, quietly, almost to herself.
Crowley, Blackwood said.
My father, she said. He thought if he documented everything carefully enough, kept it hidden, carefully enough, he'd be safe long enough to use it.
She paused.
He wasn't.
Blackwood said nothing.
I intend to be, she said.
She looked up.
I intend to be considerably more careful than my father was, and considerably less patient.
She folded the papers. She closed the Bible over them.
Senator Crowley has had 8 months to believe this was finished. He is about to discover that it is not.
Blackwood looked at her for a long moment. Outside, the child was still calling. The afternoon light was changing the way August light did in Virginia, deepening, going golden, turning the whole world briefly and deceptively beautiful before the dark came in.
Miss Carter, Blackwood said,
there is one more thing I need to tell you.
She looked at him.
Jonathan Hale, he said, was not simply guided toward the Whitmore marriage. He was given a choice. I know this because I was present when the choice was offered.
He paused, and the pause had the quality of something that had been carried for a while and was now being set down.
He was told that his family's landholdings, the Hale Tract, and two others acquired through Crowley's network would be reviewed for irregularities if he refused. He was told that certain obligations his father had accumulated would be called in. He stopped. He was told specifically that continuing his engagement to you would be interpreted as an act of opposition to Senator Crowley's interests.
Evelyn was very still.
He chose his land, she said. He chose his land.
Blackwood agreed. She thought about that. She thought about 14 months of Jonathan Hale. She thought about the particular quality of his smile at the altar that morning.
Not the smile of a man in love, she understood now, but the smile of a man who had survived something and was relieved to have come through it intact. She had thought it was love she was seeing. It had been relief.
Well, she said finally, I'm sorry, Blackwood said. I am genuinely sorry.
Don't be, she said. Her voice was level. He told you what kind of man he was. You told me what kind of woman I was this morning in that hall. She looked at the Bible in her hands. I know which one I'd rather be. She stood up. She held the Bible against her chest, and she stood in Ruth's small parlor in the late August afternoon, and she made a decision, not loudly, not with declaration, but in the particular quiet interior way of someone who has been standing at the edge of something for a long time and has simply finally stepped forward. I'm going to need paper, she said, and ink, and I'm going to need tonight.
I'll get them, Ruth said, already moving.
And General Blackwood, Evelyn said. She looked at him directly. When you go to Washington, I'm going with you. He looked at her steadily.
That, he said, is going to require some arrangement.
Then we'll arrange it, she said. My father spent years being careful and patient and quiet, and he is dead, and Senator Crowley is still drawing breath and attending weddings and moving his money through Virginia like he built it himself. She paused. I am done being patient. The decision hung in the room between them, solid and irreversible as something signed. Blackwood said nothing for a long moment. Then, I'll begin making the arrangements tomorrow. Evelyn nodded once. She went upstairs to start copying her dead father's handwriting by lamplight, word by careful word, building the architecture of a truth that a very powerful man had spent 8 months believing he had successfully buried. He had buried it in the wrong place. And now it was coming back up. She spent 3 nights copying her father's documents by lamplight. Not because it took that long, the papers were 7 sheets, and her hand was steady, and her eyes were sharp, but because she copied them twice. Once for Blackwood to carry to Washington. Once for herself, hidden in a place she told no one about, not even Ruth. She had learned something from her father's death, and the lesson was, this never put everything in one set of hands, no matter how much you trust those hands. On the fourth morning, she came downstairs to find Ruth already awake, sitting at the kitchen table with a cup of tea and an expression that meant she had been thinking since before sunrise. Jonathan came by yesterday, Ruth said. Evelyn stopped moving. When? While you were upstairs. I didn't tell him you were home. Ruth set her cup down. He looked, I don't know how to describe it. Not guilty. Not exactly. More like a man who has talked himself into believing he doesn't owe anyone anything and is working very hard to keep that belief intact. Evelyn sat down across from her. What did he want? He said he wanted to ensure there were no, and I am quoting him directly here, no unnecessary complications going forward. Ruth's voice was flat and precise. He said he hoped you understood that the situation had been regrettable, but unavoidable. Unavoidable. Evelyn repeated. That was the word he used. She thought about what Blackwood had told her, the choice Jonathan had been given the land, the threat, the particular calculation that had led him to stand at an altar and slip a ring onto another woman's finger. She thought about the fact that Jonathan had come here to Ruth's house 4 days after his wedding to make sure there would be no complications, not to apologize, to manage. What did you tell him? Evelyn said. I told him? Ruth said with the serene composure of a woman who had enjoyed this particular moment considerably that Miss Carter was not receiving visitors and would not be for the foreseeable future, and that he should direct any future correspondence to her through her solicitor. I don't have a solicitor. He doesn't know that. Evelyn looked at her cousin for a moment. Ruth, she said, I also, Ruth added, lifting her teacup again. Mentioned that Miss Carter had been in extended discussion with General Nathaniel Blackwood regarding certain matters of business. I did not elaborate. I found that his face did the elaborating for me. Evelyn went very still. Ruth, that was not safe. No, Ruth agreed calmly. But it was satisfying, and it told us something useful.
What?
That the name Nathaniel Blackwood frightens Jonathan Hale considerably, Ruth said. Which means Jonathan knows more about what Blackwood is doing than he has admitted. Which means Jonathan is more inside Crowley's network than just a land beneficiary, Evelyn finished. They looked at each other.
He's a messenger, Evelyn said slowly. Or a watcher. Someone whose job is to know what's moving and report it back.
She pushed back from the table. He didn't come here out of guilt. He came here to find out how much I know.
That was my assessment, Ruth said.
And you told him about Blackwood.
I told him enough to make him afraid, Ruth said.
Fear makes people move, and people who are afraid and moving make mistakes.
She paused.
I thought it might be useful to introduce a little urgency into the situation. Evelyn stared at her cousin.
When, she said, did you become like this?
Ruth considered this.
I believe it was approximately 8 months ago, she said, when my uncle died under suspicious circumstances, and no one did anything about it.
She set her cup down with a small, decisive click. Are we going to Washington or not?
They left 4 days later. Blackwood had arranged it with the quiet efficiency of a man accustomed to moving without attracting attention. Not a formal departure. No public announcement. No official escort. No servants beyond one trusted man named Henry, who had been with Blackwood since the war, and whose discretion Blackwood said was as reliable as his own. Evelyn and Ruth traveled in a plain coach documented as relations of a tobacco merchant making a business journey north. Blackwood rode ahead separately and would meet them at a coaching inn outside Fredericksburg. It was Ruth who noticed they were being followed. They were 2 hours out of Richmond when she reached across the carriage seat and put her hand on Evelyn's arm without saying a word. Evelyn followed her cousin's eyes to the small rear window. A rider, keeping a consistent distance, not closing the gap, not falling behind.
How long?
Evelyn murmured.
Since we left the city,
Ruth said. Evelyn thought fast.
He's not trying to stop us, she said. He's tracking us, recording that we've left where we're going.
Jonathan, Ruth said, or someone Jonathan told. She turned back forward.
We need to reach Blackwood before they do.
She called up to the driver and asked him to increase the pace on the grounds that they hoped to reach the next inn before the afternoon rain. The driver, who had been hired by Henry and had no particular investment in the fiction of the tobacco merchant, simply said, "Yes, ma'am," and picked up the speed. When they pulled into the inn at Fredericksburg, 3 hours later, Blackwood was already there. He took one look at Evelyn's face as she climbed down from the coach and said, "What happened?"
"We were followed from Richmond," she said.
"A single rider. He dropped off about an hour back, but he had us for at least 60 miles. Blackwood's expression didn't change much, but something behind his eyes did. He turned to Henry and said 3 words she didn't catch, and Henry nodded and moved away.
"Come inside," Blackwood said.
They settled in a private room at the back of the inn, the kind of room that existed in coaching houses for conversations that required walls, and Evelyn put the original documents on the table. Not the copies. The originals in her father's hand.
"I want you to see them before you carry the copies," she said.
"I want you to understand exactly what you're carrying."
He read them carefully.
All 7 sheets. He did not rush. She watched his face while he read the careful, controlled face of a man used to receiving difficult information, and beneath that control, a tightening around his jaw that told her the documents were exactly as significant as she believed them to be.
"The signature," he said when he had finished.
He set the papers down. "Your father obtained a document with Crowley's actual signature connecting him to the payment for Price's death."
"Yes."
"Do you know how?"
"Not yet," she said. "But I intend to find out. There may be more in those papers than the direct evidence. There may be a trail that tells us who else knew who else helped him."
She paused. "My father was thorough. He documented everything. He wouldn't have stopped at the signature."
Blackwood nodded slowly. "There is something I need to tell you," he said. "Something I learned this morning through a contact here in Fredericksburg."
She waited.
"Victoria Langley Ashcroft," he said.
The name was not unfamiliar to her. Victoria Langley, now Ashcroft by marriage, was the daughter of Senator Crowley's oldest political ally, a man named Richard Langley, who had served 3 terms in the Virginia legislature, and was widely understood to be the human infrastructure through which Crowley executed the more local elements of his influence. Victoria had married James Ashcroft 2 years ago in what had been called the social event of the 1813 season. Evelyn had been at that wedding. She had danced with the groom. She had thought Victoria Langley was a beautiful, composed, somewhat remote young woman who seemed entirely comfortable in the world she had been born into.
"What about her?" Evelyn said.
"She has been," Blackwood said carefully, making quiet inquiries, "on her own, for approximately a year." He paused. "Inquiries specifically about her father's involvement with Senator Crowley." Evelyn stared at him. "Victoria Ashcroft is investigating her own father," she said. "Through intermediaries she believes are discreet," Blackwood said. "One of those intermediaries has apparently been less discreet than she hoped." He paused. "She knows something about what Crowley is doing. I do not know how much, but she has been gathering it for a year, and she has done so at considerable personal risk, and she has been doing it entirely alone."
"Why?" Evelyn said.
"I don't know," Blackwood said. "That is a question I would very much like to ask her. Can we reach her?"
"She's in Washington," he said.
"Her husband has business there. They've been in the capital for 3 weeks." He paused. "Which may be entirely coincidental."
"Or may not be," Ruth said from the corner where she had been sitting with her embroidery, and Evelyn had learned to trust this paying perfect attention to every word.
"Or may not be," Blackwood agreed.
Evelyn looked at the papers on the table. She thought about Victoria Langley Ashcroft, composed remote. Victoria, daughter of Richard Langley, daughter-in-law of a respectable family wife of a business-oriented husband, spending a year quietly and alone investigating the man who had built her entire world. She understood that. She understood it in the particular way you understand something that mirrors your own experience at an angle not identical, but recognizable.
"We need to find her in Washington before Crowley's people do," Evelyn said.
"If she's been asking questions through intermediaries who talk, she may not know how exposed she already is."
"Agreed," Blackwood said. He began gathering the documents. "We leave at first light." They reached Washington in 2 days.
The city in August was hot in a way that Richmond was not, a flat river-bottom heat that seemed to press down from above and rise up from the ground simultaneously with the particular quality of a place that had been built by argument and ambition on land that had not entirely consented to the arrangement. The capital was still, in 1815, a city in the process of deciding what it was, buildings half-finished, streets half-laid, the whole enterprise carrying the slightly provisional air of something that might yet change its mind. Blackwood had arranged rooms through a contact he trusted, a retired army officer named Patterson, who asked no questions and whose small house on the Georgetown side of the city was known to exactly the people who needed to know about it and no others. On their first evening, Blackwood met with Judge Samuel Archer. He came back 2 hours later, looking like a man who had carried something heavy a long distance and had been told he needed to carry it further still.
"Well," Evelyn said.
"He'll see the documents," Blackwood said.
"He wants to meet you."
"When?"
"Tomorrow morning."
He sat down.
"He also told me something.
Something I did not know."
He looked at her directly.
"There is an existing federal investigation into Augustus Crowley. It has been running for 11 months. It is being conducted by one man, a federal marshal named Davies, and it has been deliberately kept from Crowley's knowledge, which means it has been kept from almost everyone else's as well." He paused. "Judge Archer is the oversight on that investigation." Evelyn felt the room rearrange itself slightly.
"There is already an investigation," she said. "A small one, a careful one, one that has been proceeding very slowly because it has lacked direct documentary evidence connecting Crowley to any specific act."
He looked at the satchel containing her father's papers.
"Until now."
She sat with that for a moment.
Her father had died for documents that, had they reached the right people, might have accelerated an investigation that was already happening.
The machinery of justice had been moving slowly, cautiously, carefully in exactly the direction her father had been trying to push it. And Crowley had silenced James Carter before those documents could arrive. "He killed my father," she said. "To delay something that is happening anyway."
"Yes," Blackwood said quietly. "That is what it looks like."
"Then he knows," she said. "He may not know about the investigation specifically, but he knows something is moving. Why else the careful management?" The Hale marriage, Jonathan's visit to Ruth's house, the rider on the road from Richmond. She stopped. "He is trying to contain damage he can feel, but not see."
"That is my reading as well," Blackwood said.
"Which means we have less time than I thought," she said. "Which is why the meeting with Archer tomorrow matters."
She nodded.
She was thinking about Victoria Ashcroft. About a year of quiet, solitary investigation. About a woman who had grown up inside the world they were trying to dismantle and had chosen for reasons Evelyn didn't yet understand to dismantle it anyway. "Blackwood," she said. "Victoria Ashcroft. Can you find out where she's staying in the city?" He looked at her for a moment.
"You want to contact her directly?" he said.
"I want to meet her," Evelyn said. "Before we walk into a federal judge's office with my father's documents, I want to know what else exists, what she has, what she knows." She paused.
"And I want her to know she's not doing this alone anymore."
He considered this.
"It carries risk," he said. "If she's being watched."
"Then we meet carefully," Evelyn said. "You know how to do that better than anyone." He was quiet for a moment.
"Then, I'll find out where she's staying."
He found out that night. Victoria Ashcroft was staying with her husband at a boarding house on Pennsylvania Avenue, 3 blocks from the unfinished Capitol building. She had been seen on multiple mornings walking alone in the early hours before the city came fully awake. Her husband, James Ashcroft, spent his days in meetings connected to his merchant business and was by most accounts not paying particular attention to how his wife occupied her time. The next morning, before her meeting with Judge Archer, Evelyn woke at 5 o'clock and walked to Pennsylvania Avenue. Victoria was there. She was exactly as Evelyn remembered her from 2 years ago at her own wedding. Composed, dark-haired, wearing a plain morning dress, and the expression of a woman who had been alone with her thoughts for a long time, and had made a certain peace with that. She was sitting on a low wooden bench near a water pump at the end of the block, and she looked up when Evelyn approached, and for a moment her face showed nothing at all. Then she said, "Miss Carter."
"Mrs. Ashcroft," Evelyn said.
"I apologize for the hour."
"Don't," Victoria said.
She studied Evelyn's face with the careful measuring quality of a woman evaluating something she had not expected.
"I heard you were in Washington. I assumed it was not for the season."
"No," Evelyn agreed. She sat down on the bench.
"I need to speak with you about your father."
Victoria did not flinch. She did not look away.
"I thought you might," she said.
Evelyn looked at her.
"You're not surprised?"
"No," Victoria said.
"I have spent a year assuming this conversation would happen eventually. I had not anticipated that it would be you sitting here, but—"
She paused.
"Given everything that has happened in the last week, I suppose I should have."
"What do you know," Evelyn asked directly, "about your father's involvement with Senator Crowley, about what they've done?" Victoria was quiet for a moment. Not the quiet of reluctance. The quiet of a woman deciding how to say something she has already decided to say.
"My father," she said, "keeps copies of everything. He always has. He believes that documentation is the only true form of security."
She paused.
"He keeps them in a locked room in his house in Richmond. I have known about that room since I was 15 years old. I have known the location of the key since I was 17.
She met Evelyn's eyes.
"I began making my own copies of his copies approximately 14 months ago."
Evelyn stared at her. 14 months. The same span of time as her engagement to Jonathan Hale. The same span of time her father had spent in the last careful year of his life assembling his own record.
"Why?" Evelyn said.
"Why did you start?"
Victoria looked at her hands.
Because 14 months ago, she said quietly, I overheard a conversation between my father and Senator Crowley in my father's study after dinner when they believed I had gone upstairs. She paused. They were discussing a man named James Carter. They were discussing how to ensure that whatever he was assembling would not reach anyone in Washington. She stopped. They were very calm about it, the way men are calm about things they've done before. Evelyn felt something move through her, not rage, not grief, something colder and more deliberate than either. You knew, she said. Before my father died, you knew they were going to...
I didn't know what they would do, Victoria said, and her voice cracked slightly at the edge, the first crack in the composed surface. I knew they considered him a threat. I knew they intended to neutralize him. I told myself it was business, that it meant pressure, financial pressure, legal harassment, the kind of thing they had done to others. She looked up. I told myself that right up until August of last year when I heard he had died. And then, Victoria said, I stopped telling myself things. She straightened her back. I have been copying my father's records for 14 months. I have enough to connect Senator Crowley to 6 separate incidents of what I believe to be murder extortion and the subversion of federal land policy across 4 states. She paused. I did not know what to do with it. I did not know who to trust. I have been carrying it in a locked box under my husband's bed for 14 months, and I have not told a single person. Until now, Evelyn said. Until now, Victoria agreed. They looked at each other in the early morning quiet of the Washington street, 2 women who had arrived at the same point from entirely different directions, carrying different pieces of the same enormous and dangerous truth. I have my father's documents, Evelyn said, the ones Crowley's people didn't find, including a record of the payment for William Price's death, including Crowley's signature. Victoria's breath left her.
A signature, she whispered. Direct, unambiguous. In my father's hand with supporting payment records. Victoria closed her eyes for a moment. When she opened them, something had settled in her face. Something that looked, Evelyn thought, like the particular relief of a woman who has been holding a weight alone for so long that she has forgotten what it feels like to put it down.
Then we have enough, Victoria said.
We have enough, Evelyn agreed. Judge Samuel Archer is expecting me this morning. He oversees a federal investigation that has been running for nearly a year. She paused. Will you come with me?
Victoria looked at her steadily.
Yes, she said. There is risk in this, Evelyn said. Significant risk. Crowley will know. Your father will know.
My father, Victoria said quietly, made his choices. He made them very calmly over many years with full knowledge of what he was doing. She stood up. I have made mine.
They walked together toward Patterson's house, and the city was waking around them, the early sounds of a capital coming to life. Tradesmen opening their shops, drivers moving their carts, the whole indifferent machinery of daily life, rolling forward over the top of something that was about to break it open. Blackwood was waiting at the door when they arrived. He looked at Victoria Ashcroft. Then he looked at Evelyn.
You found her, he said.
She found me. Victoria said simply. He held the door open. Inside the small front room, he laid all of it on the table. Evelyn's papers. The documents she had copied in 3 nights by lamplight. The 7 sheets in her father's hand. And then Victoria sat down beside Evelyn and opened her own satchel, the one she had been carrying through the Washington streets every morning for 2 weeks. The one she had not set down in 14 months. And she laid her copies on the table alongside them. The table filled. Ruth stood at the edge of the room, looking at the accumulated weight of it, and said nothing for a long moment. Then she said, "That is enough to end him."
"It's enough to begin," Blackwood said carefully.
"It still has to go through Archer. It still has to go through the federal process. Crowley has Allies resources and 11 years of practice in making things disappear." He paused. This will not be fast.
I know, Evelyn said.
She was looking at the table at her father's words, lying alongside Victoria's copies of her father's crimes, at the strange and terrible symmetry of it, two women, and the things their fathers had left behind. "But it will happen." She looked up at Blackwood. "Take us to Archer," she said. "All of us." Blackwood looked at her steadily. He looked at Victoria. He looked at the table. "All right," he said. He reached for his coat. And that was the moment. Not the morning in Ashford Hall. Not the garden. Not the lamplight and the copying. That was the moment things stopped being about what had been done to Evelyn Carter and started being about what Evelyn Carter intended to do. She picked up her father's papers. She picked them up and held them the way you hold something you have been given that you did not ask for and cannot return with the full weight of what they were and what they cost and what they were about to demand. And she walked out the door. Judge Samuel Archer was not what Evelyn had expected. She had built a picture of him in her mind during the walk through Washington's early morning streets, a federal judge, a man of 20 years' service, someone who had known William Price personally. She had expected gravitas, formality, the particular careful distance of a man who had spent two decades being petitioned by people who wanted things from him and had learned to keep himself behind glass. What she found was a man in his 60s with ink on his fingers and reading spectacles pushed up on his forehead, sitting behind a desk buried under enough paper to suggest he had not trusted a filing system in years. He stood when they entered. He looked at Evelyn. He looked at Victoria. He looked at Blackwood with an expression that said he had expected one person and was recalibrating for three. "General," he said. "Judge," Blackwood said. "I apologize for the additional company. Circumstances moved faster than anticipated." Archer looked at Evelyn directly. "You're James Carter's daughter."
"Yes, sir."
"I knew your father," he said, briefly. "He wrote to me in the spring of 1814. A careful letter, the kind a man writes when he wants to open a door without committing to walking through it yet." He paused. "I wrote back. He never replied." "He died 6 weeks after that letter," Evelyn said. Archer was quiet for a moment. Something moved through his face that was not quite grief, more like the expression of a man confirming something he had suspected and taken no pleasure in being right about. "Sit down," he said. "All of you." They sat. Evelyn laid the papers on the desk. Not the copies, the originals. All seven sheets. She watched Archer's face as he read, and she watched the same thing happen to him that had happened to Blackwood, the controlled surface, and beneath it, the tightening of a man receiving confirmation of something that changed the weight of everything he had been carrying. He read without speaking for 8 minutes. Then he set the papers down and looked at her. "The signature," he said. "Yes, this is Augustus Crowley's hand. I have seen his signature on federal documents. This is his hand." "Yes," she said again. He looked at Victoria. "And you are Richard Langley's daughter."
"I am,"
Victoria said. She did not look away from him. "And what you have brought?"
14 months of copies," Victoria said. "My father's records of his coordination with Senator Crowley. Financial records. Correspondence. Specific instructions regarding specific individuals." She paused. "Including instructions regarding the management of a federal customs agent named William Price in the spring of 1813.
Archer removed his spectacles from his forehead. He set them on the desk. He looked at them both, and then at Blackwood with the expression of a man standing at the edge of something very large. "You understand," he said, "what you are asking me to do."
"We're asking you to do your job," Evelyn said.
There was a beat of silence. Archer looked at her. "Miss Carter," he said. "Augustus Crowley has served in the United States Senate for 11 years. He has allies in this city that reach from the Customs House to the office of the Secretary of State. He has resources connections and 11 years of practice in anticipating exactly this kind of challenge and rendering it ineffective before it reaches a courtroom." He paused. "What you are asking me to do will take time. It will take extraordinary care,
and it will put every person in this room at considerable risk from the moment I begin.
With respect, Judge, Evelyn said, every person in this room is already at risk. My father is dead. Mrs. Ashcroft has been conducting a solitary investigation for over a year inside her own family's records. We were followed from Richmond. Crowley's network already knows something is moving, they don't yet know what, but they are watching. She kept her voice even. Time is not on our side. It has not been on our side since the morning my father sat down to write that letter to you.
Archer looked at her for a long moment. No, he said quietly. I don't suppose it has. He picked up the papers again. I need 2 days to review everything you have brought. I need to meet privately with Marshal Davies, and I need... He stopped. He looked at Blackwood. I need Jonathan Hale. The room shifted. Hale, Blackwood said carefully. He is inside Crowley's network, Archer said. I have known this for 7 months. He has not been a primary target of the investigation, because his role has appeared to be peripheral, a beneficiary, as you described him. A man who receives advantages rather than directs actions. He paused. But if he was present when Crowley's associates made the arrangement that ended Miss Carter's engagement, if he was given a direct choice and complied directly, then he is a witness. Not just a beneficiary, a witness to coercion. He looked at Evelyn. And a witness who cooperates is considerably more useful than a document because a document can be challenged. A living man who testifies under oath is significantly harder to make disappear. The silence in the room was absolute. Evelyn understood what Archer was asking. Jonathan Hale, the man who had stood at an altar 8 days ago and slipped a ring onto another woman's finger. The man who had chosen his land over her. The man who had come to Ruth's house 4 days later to ensure there were no complications. He won't cooperate willingly, she said. No, Archer agreed. Not willingly. But a man who has shown the full extent of what he is implicated in, who understands that his choice is not between cooperation and safety, but between cooperation and prosecution, sometimes discovers that his willingness is more flexible than he believed. Evelyn looked at Blackwood. Blackwood looked at Archer. I can reach him, Blackwood said slowly. I can bring him here, but if Crowley learns that Hale has had a private meeting with a federal judge, then we don't give Crowley time to learn it, Archer said. He stood up. This is what needs to happen, and it needs to happen in this order. Today, you return to your lodgings, and you speak to no one. Tonight, General Blackwood reaches out to Jonathan Hale through a channel that Crowley's watchers will not flag as significant. Tomorrow morning, Hale comes here. Tomorrow afternoon, I meet with Davies. The day after, if everything goes as it should, we move. And if it doesn't go as it should, Ruth said. Everyone looked at her. She had been sitting near the door in the composed, attentive silence that Evelyn had long ago learned to recognize as the state in which Ruth was paying the most attention. I mean, Ruth said simply, what do we do if Hale refuses, or if he goes directly to Crowley after Blackwood contacts him, or if Davies' investigation has already been compromised? Archer looked at her with something that might have been appreciation. Then, he said, we use what we have without him, and we accept that the process will be slower and the outcome less certain. He paused. But I have been in this work for 20 years, and I have learned that the thing that moves a man is rarely principle. It is almost always the clear presentation of his own situation. Jonathan Hale is not a committed man. He is a convenient one. Convenient men, when shown that the convenience has run out, tend to make pragmatic choices. They left Archer's office and walked back through the Washington streets in a silence that had its own kind of weight, the weight of something set in motion that could not now be stopped. In the afternoon, everything came apart. Evelyn was at Patterson's house reviewing her copies of the documents one more time when Henry came in with the expression of a man carrying news he had not wanted to collect. He spoke to Blackwood in a low voice near the door. Blackwood's face did not change. That Evelyn had learned in the week she had known him was how you knew it was serious, not when he reacted, but when he very deliberately did not. What is it? She said. Blackwood dismissed Henry with a nod and turned to her. Crowley knows you're in Washington, he said.
She felt her stomach drop.
How?
The rider who followed you from Richmond reported back, and apparently... He paused. Apparently Jonathan Hale told someone about his visit to Ruth's house. About my name being mentioned. He stopped. Crowley has sent two men to the city. They arrived this morning.
Do they know about Archer? She said immediately.
Not yet. That meeting has not been connected, but they know you are here, and they know I am with you, and they are trying to find out what we are doing. Victoria, who had been sitting across the room, said, My husband. They both looked at her. Her face had gone very still.
James received a visitor this morning, she said slowly. Before I left. A man I didn't recognize. They spoke privately.
James was different afterward, quieter. He asked me at breakfast whether I had seen you recently, Evelyn. He doesn't know your name. I have never mentioned you to him. She paused. He was given your name by someone who wanted to know if I was connected to you.
Your husband's business contacts, Blackwood said. How deep does that go?
I don't know, Victoria said. And for the first time, she sounded uncertain. Not afraid, but genuinely uncertain in the way a person sounds when they realize the walls of their own house have been listening. I have always believed James was separate from my father's work, that he was a merchant and nothing more. She stopped. I am no longer certain of that.
The room held that for a moment.
You need to go back to him, Evelyn said.
Victoria looked at her sharply. You need to go back and behave exactly as you normally would, Evelyn said. If you don't return at your usual hour, if you behave differently, they will know you've been warned.
She held Victoria's gaze.
Can you do that?
Victoria was quiet for a moment. The question beneath the question was clear to all of them. Could she go back to a man who might be reporting her movements to the network that had killed Evelyn's father, and sit at dinner with him and act as if nothing had changed?
Yes, Victoria said. Her voice was steady. I can do that.
Take nothing with you, Blackwood said. Leave everything here. Victoria looked at her satchel, the one she had carried for 14 months, the one she had not set down. She looked at it for a moment with the expression of someone saying goodbye to a weight they have carried so long it has become a part of them. She left it on the chair and walked out. Blackwood turned to Evelyn immediately.
We need to move the documents, he said. Not Archer's office. Somewhere Crowley's men would not think to look and cannot access without authority.
He paused. There is a church, St. John's on the square. The minister is a man named Carroll, who served as a chaplain under my command. He would keep something for me without asking what it was.
Do it, Evelyn said, tonight. And Hale, he said.
I need to reach him before Crowley's men realize what we're doing. If Hale gets approached by Crowley's people first, if he's told we're here, if he's told what's at stake, he may decide that cooperation with Crowley is the safer choice.
Then don't give him time to decide, Ruth said.
They all looked at her.
Send word tonight, Ruth said.
Not through Henry. Not through anyone connected to you. She looked at Evelyn.
Through me.
Ruth, Evelyn started.
I am invisible, Ruth said firmly. I am a woman staying at a boarding house. No one is watching me because no one thinks I matter.
She paused. Let me carry the message to Hale. I can do it tonight before anyone knows I've moved.
Blackwood looked at her for a moment.
What boarding house are the Hales at? He asked.
I don't know, Ruth said. But I know who does.
She looked at Evelyn.
Charlotte Whitmore Hale's maid. She was at the Ashford wedding. I spoke to her three times during the reception while you were in the garden. Her name is Daisy, and she is the kind of woman who remembers a kindness.
She paused. I was kind to her. The room was quiet. Then Evelyn said,
Of course you were.
Ruth was already standing. She left within the hour. Blackwood moved the documents to St. John's. Henry kept watch on the street outside Patterson's house, noting the movement of two men who had arrived that afternoon, and whose interest in the neighborhood was not casual.
Evelyn sat alone in the small back room and did the thing that was hardest, which was nothing, waiting, thinking, holding everything steady in her mind, while the city moved around her, and the pieces of what they had built over the past week were tested against the weight of what Crowley could bring down on them. She thought about her father. She thought about him sitting in his study in Richmond, the study that had been emptied after his death, writing his careful, dangerous records by lamplight in the same way she had copied them 3 nights ago. 2 generations of the same act, separated by death and 8 months of silence. He had believed in the process. He had believed that if you documented everything carefully enough, built the case completely enough, the machinery of justice would eventually engage and do what it was built to do. He had been right about that. He had just not lived to see it. She intended to. Ruth came back at 9 o'clock with mud on her hem and the expression of a woman who has accomplished something she intends to remain modest about. "He'll be at Archer's office at 7 tomorrow morning," she said. "Not 8, 7. He wants to be gone before anyone who might be watching the building has fully positioned themselves." Evelyn stared at her. He agreed immediately. "No," Ruth said. "He argued for 20 minutes. He said he had no obligation. He said he had done nothing illegal. He said his family's interests were at stake. And he could not be expected to..." She paused. "And then I told him that Senator Crowley had ordered the death of James Carter, and that we had the documentary proof, and that the federal investigation currently under Judge Archer's oversight was not going to be selective about who it implicated." She sat down. He agreed after that. "What exactly did you say to him?" Blackwood said. Ruth considered. "I said that the question was not whether this was going to happen, but whether Jonathan Hale was going to be remembered as a man who helped or a man who was helped along." She paused. "I may have also mentioned that Miss Carter had asked me to personally ensure he understood the full extent of his situation." Evelyn looked at her cousin. "You told him I sent you. I thought it might carry a certain weight," Ruth said, "given how recently he stood at an altar and made his choice. Men like Jonathan Hale are moved by the opinion of the people they've wronged, even when they pretend they're not." Ruth was right. She was almost always right. At 7 the next morning, Jonathan Hale walked into Judge Archer's office. Evelyn was not there. Blackwood had advised against it, and for once, she had agreed with him. Not because she couldn't bear to see Jonathan, but because she understood with the cold clarity that had been replacing her personal feelings one by one since the morning in Ashford Hall, that her presence would make the conversation about the wrong things. It would make it about the wedding, the ring, the choices he had made in his personal life. She needed it to be about Crowley. She waited at Patterson's house with Ruth and Victoria, who had returned the previous evening, with the careful composure of a woman who had sat through dinner with her husband, answered his questions about her day, with the truth in all the details that didn't matter, and felt for the first time in her marriage that she was entirely alone inside it. "Is he involved?" Evelyn had asked her quietly when they were sitting without the men. Victoria was quiet for a long time. "I think," she said finally, "that he has chosen not to know certain things. Deliberately. In the way that people choose not to know things when knowing them would require them to act differently than they wish to act." She paused. "Which is its own kind of choice." "Yes," Evelyn said. "It is." They did not speak of it again that night. Blackwood came back from Archer's office at 10 o'clock. He came in, and he sat down, and he looked at Evelyn with an expression she had not seen on him before. Something that was not quite relief, because relief was too simple for what was in his face. It was more like the expression of a man who has watched something he built under difficult conditions actually hold its weight. "Hale talked," he said. Evelyn breathed. "He talked for 2 hours," Blackwood said. "He confirmed everything. The meeting where he was given the choice regarding the engagement. The specific men who delivered the message on Crowley's behalf. The financial arrangements made with his father regarding the Hale tract." He paused. "And one thing we did not know." "What?" Evelyn said. "Richard Langley," he said. He looked at Victoria. "Your father was not simply Crowley's ally.
He was his executor. The specific instructions regarding your father, Evelyn, the timing, the management of the death, the subsequent handling of the estate, all of those directions came through Richard Langley. Crowley gave the order. Langley carried it out. The room was very still. Victoria did not move. She sat with her hands folded in her lap and the expression of a woman who has been preparing for a truth for 14 months and finds when it arrives that preparation does not actually make it easier to receive. "My father," she said. Not a question. Just the two words sitting in the air. "Victoria." Evelyn started.
"No,"
Victoria said quietly. "Don't." She took a slow breath. "I knew. I have known since that conversation I overheard. I have known, and I have spent 14 months trying to build enough evidence to make it something other than just my word against his." She looked up. Her eyes were dry. Her voice was steady. "Does Archer know?"
"He knows," Blackwood said.
Hale named Langley specifically. "Archer is meeting with Davies this afternoon. He believes they now have sufficient basis to move to formal proceedings." He paused. "Both Crowley and Langley." Victoria nodded once. She stood up. She walked to the window. And then she said something that Evelyn would remember for the rest of her life, in the particular way you remember things said in moments when someone shows you who they actually are, underneath everything they have been required to be. "He used to read to me," Victoria said, "when I was small. Every Sunday evening after church, he would sit in the big chair by the fire, and I would sit on the footstool, and he would read to me for an hour." She paused. "He was a good reader, very expressive. He made all the voices different." She stopped. "I used to think he was the most wonderful man in the world." No one said anything. "I want him to face what he has done," she said. "Not because I don't love him, but because love is not the same as protection. And I am done protecting men who use that confusion to keep doing harm." She turned from the window. Her face was composed and certain and quietly devastated in equal measure. "What do we do next?" Blackwood looked at Evelyn. Evelyn looked at Victoria. "We wait for Archer," Evelyn said. "And we stay close and stay quiet, and we let the machinery do what we built it to do." She paused. "And then when it's done, we go home." But going home, it turned out, was not yet possible. Because that afternoon, while they were waiting, Henry came in from the street with his jaw set and said two words, "Crowley's here." Not his men, not his proxies, not the riders and watchers and intermediaries he deployed like chess pieces across Virginia and Washington alike. Augustus Crowley himself had arrived in the Federal City. Blackwood went very still. "When?" he said. "An hour ago," Henry said. "Came in with a full escort. He went directly to the Capitol building. He has already requested a meeting with two members of the Senate Commerce Committee for this afternoon." "He knows," Evelyn said. "He knows something has moved. He's come to contain it personally." "He doesn't know about Hale's testimony," Blackwood said. "He can't know yet." "But he knows about the investigation," Evelyn said. "Or he suspects it. He wouldn't come himself unless he felt something slipping." She looked at Blackwood. "How long does Archer need?" "He said the day after tomorrow," Blackwood said. "We don't have the day after tomorrow," Evelyn said. "Crowley is here. He has Senate allies. The moment he starts making inquiries, the moment he starts applying pressure to the right people, he could have this buried before Archer even formalizes the proceedings." She paused. "We need to move tonight." Blackwood looked at her. "Archer will not move tonight," he said. "He is a careful man, a methodical man. He will not be rushed into action before he believes the case is completely ready." "Then I'll go to him myself," Evelyn said. "Tonight. And I'll make him understand what careful and methodical costs us if Crowley reaches his Senate allies before Archer reaches the formal record." She was already moving. Blackwood caught her arm. Not roughly, just firmly, the way a man stops something he needs to think about before it goes through the door. "Listen to me," he said. "If you go to Archer tonight alone and Crowley's men are watching the building
and they will be watching the building. You will confirm everything they suspect. They will know exactly where the threat is coming from. He paused. Let me go. Archer knows me. He will hear me in a way he might not hear you, not because you aren't. Don't, she said. Not because of that, he said. Because I have history with him, shared history, the kind of shorthand that makes a man move faster. He held her gaze. Let me go. She looked at him. She thought about her father, about doing things alone, about not telling the people who might have helped, about carrying everything close and quiet until there was no more time. She thought about what that cost. All right, she said. She released his arm. Go. He went. She sat in Patterson's house with Ruth and Victoria and Henry keeping watch, and she waited, and the evening pressed in around them, and somewhere in the city, Augustus Crowley was having conversations designed to close the doors they were trying to open. She thought about the morning in Ashford Hall. She thought about how that morning had felt like the end of something. Her engagement, her standing, her father's house, the shape of the future she had believed she was building. She thought about how it had turned out to be the beginning of something instead. Not anything she would have chosen. Not anything she would wish on herself. But a beginning nonetheless. She thought about what Blackwood had said to her in the garden that morning, with the river moving below them, and the sound of the wedding drifting out. You were never part of the story they wrote for you. She hadn't believed him then. She had been too raw, too emptied, too occupied with the immediate business of remaining upright. She believed him now. Blackwood came back at midnight. He came in with his coat still on, and his face carrying the particular expression she had come to recognize as the one that meant something significant had happened, and he was organizing how to tell her. Archer is moving tomorrow morning, he said. First light. He has Davies. He has Hale's testimony. He has your father's documents and Victoria's records. He paused. And he has something else. What? Evelyn said. A deposition, Blackwood said. Signed tonight. By a man named Charles Fielding, a clerk in Crowley's office, who has been Davies' informant for 6 months and has been waiting for authorization to come forward formally. He stopped. Fielding has direct knowledge of the order regarding William Price. He was in the room when it was given. He held her gaze. He heard Crowley say the words. The room went absolutely quiet. Ruth put down her embroidery. Victoria looked up from the chair where she had been sitting. Evelyn said nothing for a moment. Then, tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning, Blackwood said. She nodded. She looked at the table where the satchel sat and the Bible beneath it, and the 7 sheets of her father's handwriting that had been hidden for 8 months in the pages of Psalms in a book nobody thought to take. Then we're ready, she said. They did not sleep. Not truly. Ruth dozed in her chair for an hour and woke herself twice checking the street through the curtain. Victoria sat with her hands folded and her eyes open and the particular stillness of a woman who has already done her grieving and come out the other side into something harder and quieter than grief. Henry kept his post at the door. Blackwood sat across from Evelyn at the small table with a cup of cold coffee he never drank, and they went through everything one final time. Not because there was anything left to check, but because going through it was better than sitting still inside the waiting. Fielding, Evelyn said. The clerk. What happens to him after he testifies? Archer has arranged protection, Blackwood said. He'll be moved out of Washington before the formal proceedings begin. And Hale? Blackwood was quiet for a moment. That depends on how cooperative he continues to be. Archer made no promises. He made implications. She nodded. She had stopped feeling much about Jonathan Hale somewhere around midnight. Not forgiveness, she was not there yet. And she was honest enough with herself not to pretend otherwise. More like the particular absence of feeling you reach when something has been examined from every angle, and there is simply nothing left to extract from it. He had made his choice. His choice had consequences. Whatever those consequences turned out to be was no longer her primary concern. Blackwood, she said. He looked at her. After tomorrow, she said. If this works when this works, what happens to us? To this.
She stopped because she was not entirely sure what word belonged at the end of that sentence. Arrangement. Partnership. Whatever it was they had built in the garden behind Ashford Hall, and in coaching inns, and small back rooms across Virginia and Washington over the past 2 weeks. He looked at her for a long moment. "That," he said, "is a conversation I would very much like to have, when we are not waiting for dawn and a federal proceeding." "Fair enough," she said. "But I will say this." He set down the cold cup. "I came to that wedding because I had been watching the situation around Crowley for 2 years, and I had run out of patience. I came because I knew James Carter had been silenced, and I could not prove it, and it had been sitting in my chest like something I could not put down." He paused. "I did not expect to walk out of that hall with a reason that had nothing to do with documents or evidence or strategy." She looked at him. "And yet," she said. "And yet," he agreed. Ruth from her chair said without opening her eyes, "Some of us are trying to rest." Evelyn looked at her cousin. "You are not resting," she said. "I am attempting to," Ruth said. "The two of you are making it difficult." Dawn came in gray and quiet, the way Washington dawns did in August, the heat arriving before the light, the city beginning its noise while the sky was still deciding what color it intended to be. Henry made coffee that was actually hot. Victoria accepted a cup and drank it standing. Blackwood went over the sequence one final time with Henry, and then he put on his coat and he turned to Evelyn. "Ready," he said. "Since 8 months ago," she said. They walked to Archer's office in two groups by different routes, arriving within minutes of each other. Marshall Davies was already there when Evelyn arrived, a compact, precise man in his 40s, with the careful eyes of someone who had spent years watching things without being seen watching them. He looked at her when she entered with the particular assessment of a man deciding in real time how much of what he had heard about her was accurate. Whatever he decided, he nodded once. "Miss Carter," he said. "Your father was a thorough man." "Yes," she said. "He was." "So are you by the look of things." She said nothing to that. She sat down. She put her father's Bible on the table. The original, the one she had carried from Ruth's house, the one that had been her grandmother's and then her father's, and was now hers, and she put her hands flat on the cover and she looked at Archer. "Tell me what happens today," she said. "Exactly. Every step." Archer laid it out. Davies' formal deposition from Fielding the clerk would be entered into federal record that morning. Combined with the documents Evelyn had provided, and Victoria's 14 months of copied records, Archer had sufficient basis to issue a formal writ compelling Senator Augustus Crowley to appear before a federal inquiry within 72 hours. The writ would be served today. Simultaneously, a separate writ would be served on Richard Langley in Richmond.
"Simultaneously," Evelyn said. "That's important."
"Critical," Archer agreed. "If Langley receives word before the writ arrives, he will begin moving assets and altering records. The same is true of Crowley. They cannot know about each other's situation before they are each formally compelled." He paused. "Which means the next 4 hours are the most dangerous part of this entire process. If either of them learns what is happening before Davies' men reach them, they'll run," Victoria said. It was the first thing she had said since they'd arrived, and her voice was very steady. "My father will run. He is not a man who faces things he cannot control. He is a man who removes himself from situations and lets others manage the consequences." Archer looked at her. "We have men positioned in Richmond since yesterday evening," he said more gently than his usual register. "He will not have the opportunity."
Victoria nodded. She looked at her hands. She did not say anything more. The writ for Crowley was issued at 9 o'clock in the morning. Davies took it personally. He did not send a deputy. He did not send a message in advance. He walked into the building where Senator Augustus Crowley was holding his second meeting of the morning with two members of the Senate Commerce Committee, and he handed the document to the senator directly in front of witnesses. Evelyn was not there to see it. She heard about it afterward from Blackwood, who heard it from Davies, who described Crowley's face with the precise, unemotional accuracy of a professional who had delivered bad news in rooms full of important people many times and had long since stopped being impressed by the importance. Crowley had read the writ. He had read it twice. He had looked up at Davies and said very quietly, "This is a mistake." Davies had said, "That will be for the inquiry to determine, Senator." And Crowley had said nothing more.
When Blackwood told her this, Evelyn thought about what it meant, the quiet of a man who has operated for 11 years inside a world of his own construction, a world where his word shaped outcomes and his name closed doors and his signature on a document meant the matter was resolved. She thought about the particular silence of a man feeling that world's walls begin to move. She did not feel satisfaction exactly. She felt something more like completion, like the closing of a door that had been left open and letting weather in for 8 months. By noon, word had reached them that the Richmond writ had been served on Richard Langley. Victoria received the news standing with her arms at her sides and her face absolutely composed. She did not cry. She did not speak for a full minute. Then she said, "Is he in federal custody?" Blackwood said, "Temporary pending the inquiry. He is safe. He has not been harmed." "I wasn't asking if he was harmed," Victoria said. Her voice was quiet. "I was asking if he admitted it." Blackwood paused. "He said nothing. His attorney was called immediately." Victoria nodded. "Of course he was," she breathed. "He will say nothing for as long as he can manage it. He will protect Crowley, because protecting Crowley has always been how he protected himself." She paused. "He will not understand until it is too late that Crowley cannot protect him now." She was right. They learned that 3 days later. The federal inquiry began formally on a Thursday morning, and by Thursday afternoon, with both Fielding's testimony and Hale's deposition, entered into record with Evelyn's father's documents, authenticated by 3 independent handwriting witnesses, with Victoria's 14 months of copies cross-referenced against federal shipping and payment records that Davies had been quietly assembling for 11 months by Thursday afternoon. Crowley's attorney had requested a private meeting with Archer. Evelyn was in Patterson's house when Blackwood came back from that meeting. She took one look at his face. "He's negotiating," she said. "He's negotiating," Blackwood confirmed. "He is offering his full cooperation regarding the systematic corruption of the Virginia Land Commission in exchange for reduced charges on everything else." He sat down. "His attorney is suggesting the murder charge is speculative, that the signature is authentic, but the document's provenance cannot be fully established. That Fielding's testimony as an informant of 6 months' standing is self-interested." "It's a delay," Evelyn said immediately. "He's buying time. He thinks if he can drag the inquiry out long enough, something will shift, an ally will intervene, a witness will reconsider a document, will become questionable." She was already thinking. "What does Archer say?" "Archer is not negotiating on the murder charge," Blackwood said. "He told Crowley's attorney directly that the full scope of the inquiry would proceed regardless of any cooperation offer. He said..." He paused, and something in his expression told her that what came next was significant. "He said that the family of James Carter had provided documentation that makes the matter of Price's death not speculative, but demonstrable, and that the inquiry would proceed on that basis without exception." The family of James Carter. She sat with those words for a moment. Her father's name in the mouth of a federal proceeding. His work, the careful, dangerous, ultimately fatal work of his last year, being called by what it was, evidence. Fact. Something that could not be made to disappear by a quiet estate settlement and 3 days to clear her belongings. "And Langley," she said. "Langley broke this morning," Blackwood said. The room went still. Victoria, who had been at the window, turned around. "He broke," she said. "He was shown the full extent of what Crowley's attorney is offering, the cooperation deal that throws Langley's specific role into sharpest relief in exchange for reduced charges against Crowley himself." Blackwood looked at Victoria directly. "Your father understood what was being traded. He has provided a written statement to Marshal Davies.
A full accounting. Names, dates, specific instructions. His own role and Crowley's. He paused. Including James Carter. The silence in the room had weight. Victoria pressed her lips together. She turned back to the window. Her shoulders were very straight. He protected Crowley for 30 years, she said. And Crowley traded him in 4 days.
Yes, Blackwood said quietly.
Good, Victoria said. The word was small and final, and carried the entire 14 months of what it had cost her. Then he knows what he built. It took 3 more weeks. 3 weeks of depositions and cross-references and legal arguments in rooms Evelyn was not allowed into. 3 weeks of waiting in Patterson's house, and Ruth's careful management of the household, and Henry's quiet surveillance of the street. 3 weeks of Blackwood coming back from meetings with Archer, with the particular expression that told her things were moving. But slowly, the way justice always moved, not like a river, but like something being built by hand, one stone at a time, in weather that did not cooperate. Jonathan Hale came to Patterson's house on the 9th day. Evelyn did not expect him. Henry opened the door, and Hale was standing there in a coat he had not dressed carefully, in the coat of a man who had left somewhere in a hurry and was not thinking about how he looked. He asked for Miss Carter. Henry looked at Evelyn. Evelyn nodded. He came in. He stood in the small front room, and he looked at her with the expression she had last seen in the back of Ashford Hall, that complicated, calculated, quietly uneasy look of a man who had made a correct assessment and found no peace in it. I wanted to, he started. Don't apologize, she said. Not unkindly, just directly. I don't need it, and I don't think it's actually what you came here to do. He was quiet for a moment. No, he admitted. I came because... He stopped. He looked at his hands. I came because I wanted to know if you were all right. She looked at him. I'm all right, she said. I heard what's happening with the inquiry, with Crowley. He paused. My testimony. Matters, she said. It matters, and it will be considered, and whatever comes of it will come of it. She held his gaze. Is that what you needed to know? He nodded. Slowly. Like a man releasing something he had been holding too long. I am sorry, he said. I know you said not to. But I am. She looked at him for a long moment at the man she had agreed to marry 14 months ago. The man she had believed in. The man who had chosen his land and his comfort and the path of least resistance when the choice came to him. She looked at him, and she felt not love, not anymore, and not quite hate, and not the hollow numbness she had felt at midnight. She felt something more like the specific sadness you feel for people who are smaller than you hoped they were. I know, she said. Go home, Jonathan. He went. She stood in the middle of the room for a moment after the door closed, and then she breathed and she let it be finished. On the 22nd day, Senator Augustus Crowley announced his resignation from the United States Senate. He did not admit guilt. His statement, read by his attorney in a brief address, cited the pressures of prolonged public service and the need to attend to private affairs. It was the statement of a man who had run out of moves and was declining to articulate the fact publicly. It said nothing about James Carter. It said nothing about William Price. It said nothing about land commissions or shipping routes or the network of obligation and silence he had built across 4 states over 11 years. But it was read in the same week that the federal inquiry formally charged him with the murder of William Price, conspiracy to defraud the federal government, and the subversion of federal land policy across Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia. The resignation did not make those charges disappear. Nothing made those charges disappear. Evelyn was sitting in Patterson's front room when Blackwood came in with the news, and she heard it, and she said nothing for a long moment. Ruth was beside her. Victoria was across the room. Henry was at the door. These people, this small, unlikely collection of people who had assembled themselves around a Bible in a guest room in Richmond and somehow carried its contents all the way to a federal inquiry in Washington, were all in the same room when the news arrived. Evelyn looked at the Bible on the table. She thought about her father. She thought about him sitting in his Richmond study,
in the last year of his life, writing in his careful, cramped hand, documenting things that powerful men had done and believed would never be accounted for. She thought about how alone he must have felt. How afraid, maybe, though James Carter had not been a man who admitted fear even to himself. How determined. She thought about the particular stubborn courage it took to do what he had done in the full knowledge of what it might cost him. It had cost him everything, and it had counted anyway. "Papa," she said, quietly, to herself or to something she wasn't entirely sure what she believed about where the dead went, but she said it the way you say something when you need it to reach somewhere beyond the room you're in. It counted. Ruth took her hand. She led her. Victoria said from across the room, "What happens now for you?" Evelyn looked up. "I go home," she said. "And then, I find a home to go to." "You'll rebuild," Victoria said. It was not a question. "Yes," Evelyn said. "Something, somewhere." She paused. "Not the same thing. I don't think I want the same thing." Victoria nodded slowly. She understood that in the particular way of someone who was facing the same question from a different direction. What do you rebuild when what you were building turns out to have been constructed on ground you didn't choose and couldn't trust? How do you start again when starting again means starting from a place you never expected to be standing? "I'll be in Richmond," Victoria said. "When the inquiry concludes, I'll be in Richmond." She paused. "I don't know what my marriage is at this point. I don't know what my family is." She said it with a steadiness that was not coldness, just the honest acknowledgement of a woman who has been precise about what she knows and what she doesn't. "But I know what I'm not. And I know what I won't allow." She looked at Evelyn. "That feels like enough to start with." "It is," Evelyn said. "It's more than enough." Blackwood drove them back to Richmond 2 days later. They left Washington in the early morning, before the city was fully awake, the same way they had arrived quietly, without announcement, with Henry on the box, and the plain coach, and no escort, and nothing about their departure that would attract attention. The inquiry was informal proceedings. Crowley was under federal charge. Langley was cooperating. The machinery had engaged. It was no longer theirs to drive. It was theirs to wait for, and they could wait in Richmond as easily as in Washington more easily, because Richmond was home, or had been, and because home, even the complicated, painful, changed version of it, was still better than anywhere else when you were ready to stop running. For the first hour of the journey, no one said much. The road unrolled behind them, and Virginia came back gradually, the specific quality of the air, the sound of the land, the green summer weight of it on every side. Evelyn watched it through the coach window and felt the strange quiet sensation of returning to a place that was the same and finding herself entirely different from the person who had left it. Blackwood was riding alongside the coach. Through the window she could see him now and then, the dark coat, the straightness of his posture in the saddle, the way he rode with the careful, unhurried attention of a man who trusts the ground beneath him and is in no particular hurry to prove anything to it. After a while, Ruth said, "Are you going to keep looking at him through the window, or are you going to open it?" Evelyn looked at her cousin. "I'm thinking," she said. "You've been thinking since Richmond," Ruth said, "which is a significant number of miles of thinking. I'll think faster if you stop commenting on it." Ruth smiled and looked away. Evelyn opened the window. The summer air came in warm and green and carrying the particular quality of Virginia in August honeysuckle and red clay and the far-off sound of water. Blackwood glanced over at the movement. He slowed his horse slightly to match the coach's pace. "All right," he said.
"Yes,"
she said.
"You."
"Better than I've been in 2 years," he said. And he said it simply without flourish, the way he said most things, as if the truth needed no particular decoration to be what it was. She looked at him. "I've been thinking," she said, "about what you said, in the garden, at the beginning."
"Which part?"
"The part about not offering charity," she said. "About offering your arm, about the difference being significant." He looked at her steadily with that dark, direct gaze that she had spent 2 weeks learning to read and was still not entirely finished learning.
I remember, he said.
I think, she said slowly, that I understand now what you meant. At the time I thought it was a distinction between pity and something else. But I don't think that's it. She paused. I think what you meant was that some things are offered without conditions attached, without the expectation of a particular response or a particular outcome or a particular shape of gratitude. She looked at him. I think you meant that there's a kind of offering that simply says here, take this or don't, but it's yours to take. He was quiet for a moment.
Yes, he said. That is what I meant.
I took it, she said.
I know, he said.
I'd take it again, she said,
for whatever that is worth.
He looked at her long enough that the road kept moving and the summer kept pressing its warm green weight around them, and the coach swayed slightly on a turn, and Ruth pretended with great concentration to look at something on the other side of the vehicle.
It's worth a great deal, he said. To me.
She sat back. She breathed. Outside, Virginia continued unhurried, indifferent, enormous, in the way that landscapes are enormous when you are small enough inside something to see how large the world is around you. She thought about her father. She thought about his careful handwriting and his hidden documents and the Bible he had left on the shelf without knowing he was leaving it for her. She thought about the morning in Ashford Hall that had felt like an ending and turned out to be the first step of the longest, hardest, most clarifying journey of her life. She thought about who she had been when she walked into that hall, a woman waiting for a future someone else had shaped for her, standing in a room full of people who had decided what her worth was and found it insufficient. She thought about who she was now sitting in a plain coach on a Virginia road in August 1815, with her father's Bible in her hands and a senator's resignation behind her, and the full weight of what she had done settling into her bones like something permanent. She was not the same woman. She was not the woman who had pressed her nails into her palm to keep from making a sound. She was not the woman who had been given 3 days to clear her belongings and had gone quietly. She was not the woman who had stood in the back of a room and waited for someone else to determine her place in it. She was James Carter's daughter, thorough, careful, stubborn, and entirely unwilling to let the things that mattered be quietly disappeared by men who believed they could afford to. She was Evelyn Carter. She had rewritten the story they had written for her. And when the coach rolled back into Richmond on a warm August evening, and the familiar streets came up around her, and Ruth reached over and took her hand again, and Blackwood's horse came alongside the window one final time before they reached their destination, she was not arriving as someone returning from defeat. She was arriving as someone who had gone out into the world with her dead father's words in a Bible and come back having made them count. Augustus Crowley would stand before a federal inquiry and answer for what he had done to William Price, to James Carter, to the men and women whose land and livelihoods had been moved like pieces in a game they were never told they were playing. Richard Langley would sit across from his daughter in some future room and find that her love for him had not disappeared, but that it would not ever again be confused with protection. Jonathan Hale would live the rest of his life as a man who had been given a choice and made it, and who would have to find a way to carry that with whatever grace he was capable of. And Evelyn Carter would rebuild. Not the same life. Not the life that had been arranged for her, shaped for her, offered to her, as if it were the only shape available for a woman of her station and her time and her particular inconvenient stubbornness. Something of her own choosing. Something built on ground she had tested herself and found solid. She had walked out of Ashford Hall on the arm of a man who'd offered it because she deserved better than standing alone in that room, and she had taken that offer and carried it all the way to the truth, and the truth had done what her father always believed it would do if only someone could get it far enough into the light. She had gotten it there, and that all of it, every hard and dangerous and grief-soaked mile of it, was entirely, permanently, irrevocably hers.